like to acknowledge my colleague here, Eva Jakubowska-Lorenz, who has been with our embassy for 6 months and taken over duties from Beata Malewska, who many of you have worked with. Eva is covering all of our programs related to Polish-Jewish relations, as well as tolerance issues and programs focusing on opposing racism. And she is also responsible for cooperation with NGOs. So that's about us. Now, Rachel F. Brenner is a professor of Jewish studies and a professor of modern Hebrew literature at the Department of Hebrew Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's published widely on responses to the Holocaust in the Jewish diaspora literature, Israeli literature, and Polish literature. And she just told me that she was born in Poland and speaks the language quite well, so I think she will bring an interesting insight. Now, among her publications are Assimilation and Assertion, The Response to the Holocaust in Mordecai Rickler's Writings, A.M. Klein, the Father of Canadian Jewish Literature, Essays in the Poetics of Humanistic Passion, which received the Book Committee of the Jewish Federation of Greater Toronto Literary Scholarship Award, Writing as Resistance, Four Women Confronting the Holocaust, Edith Stein, Simone Weil, Anne Frank, and Eddie Hilsum, Inextricably Bonded, Israeli, Jewish, and Arab Writers Revisioning Culture, and the Freedom to Write, The Woman Artist and the World in Ruth Almog's Fiction in Hebrew. Her current project is The Ethics of Witnessing, The Holocaust in Polish Writers' Diaries from Warsaw, 1939. This focuses on Warsaw Polish writers' diaristic responses to the Holocaust, and it's forthcoming from the Northwestern University Press in next year, 2014. So we'll go back to Justyna now, and I hope you find this event as interesting as I know I will. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Temat, który podejmuje profesor Rachel, jest kolejnym głosem w debacie o rolę hilbergowskich bystanders, czyli świadków. Rola Polaków w zagładzie jest dość istotnym tematem w dyskursie naukowym i publicystycznym. Pytanie to warto wciąż zadawać, w szczególności w takim miejscu, jak jesteśmy dzisiaj, czyli w Muzeum Historii Żydów Polskich. Pragnę tylko przypomnieć, że przełomowym tekstem, esejem na temat roli Polaków w zagładzie jest esej Jana Błońskiego Biedni Polacy patrzą na getto, publikowany w Tygodniku Powszechnym w 1987 roku. Kolejna ważna i szokująca publikacja to był Strach Jana Tomasza Grossa. W ostatnich latach wyszły kolejne ważne, interesujące, przełomowe książki naukowców związanych z Centrum Badań nad Zagładą Żydów. I tutaj wymienię kilka tytułów. To jest między innymi książka Jacka Leociaka Ratowanie opowieści Polaków i Żydów. Książka Barbary Engelking Jest taki piękny, słoneczny dzień. Losy Żydów szukających ratunku na wsi polskiej w latach 42-45. Czy też książka Tadeusza Markiela i Aliny Skibińskiej. Jakie to ma znaczenie? Czy zrobili to z chciwości? Zagłada domu Trynczerów. Już za chwilę oddam mikrofon profesor Brenner po to, abyśmy mogli wysłuchać jej wykładu na temat, jest to analiza 5 dzienników polskich intelektualistów pisanych w czasie zagłady. Część z tych osób jest nam znana głównie z lektur szkolnych, między innymi Zofia Naukowska, której opowiadanie Medaliony dla wielu polskich licealistów jest takim pierwszym wprowadzeniem do tematu zagłady. Oczywiście ona mówi również o Marii Dąbrowskiej, o Jarosławie Iwaszkiewiczu. Mniej znani pisarze to Aurelia Wyleżyńska oraz Stanisław Rembek, autor powieści Wyrok na Franciszka Kłosa, który w większości nam jest znany z ekranizacji zrobionej przez Andrzeja Wajdę. W kulturze polskiej, zwłaszcza przedwojennej i wojennej, niezwykle silny był etos inteligencji, która była traktowana jako środowisko opiniotwórcze, jako taki wskaźnik moralny. Wydaje mi się, że mamy dzisiaj niezwykłą okazję, żeby na tych intelektualistów spojrzeć jako na osoby prywatne, dowiedzieć się, jak oni w swoich dziennikach, w swoich prywatnych notatkach mierzyli się z zagładą Żydów i czym dla nich było być świadkami zagłady. Zapraszam do wykładu, a potem do dyskusji zaraz po nim. Professor Rachel, the floor is yours.
Welcome everybody. Thank you for coming. I think I'm very honored, most honored to be here. And first of all, a few thank yous which are completely in order. Mr. Mark Wink, who is the attaché, the cultural attaché of the embassy, and I want to thank embassy and the United States government for supporting that. I would like to thank Ms. Eva Jakubowska-Lorenz for arranging all this. She's the cultural affairs assistant, and she made it all possible. And I would like to thank Ms. Justyna Majewska for being here with me and for her support. So it is a great honor for me to be in this museum talking about Polish writers, and I hope introducing some different, of slightly or maybe not so slightly different a view of people in a general atmosphere that that Ms. Majewska mentioned now. She mentioned Błoński's famous article about the Christian looks at the ghetto, and I'm coming to it because, of course, it's a paraphrase of Miłosz's poem. But I am not going to talk about the debates. I'm not going to talk about who is guilty and who is not guilty, who could have done more and not, and haven't done more, because all these debates that are so preoccupying and have been so preoccupying for such a long time, they are talking about post-factum, in other words, appreciation of what, in terms of what happened, but appreciating in the aftermath of the Holocaust, in the aftermath of the war. And what I am going to do, I'm going to present to you documents that were written in time, in medias res, in time of the war, and to see the responses when the things were happened, not post factum, but in medias res. And what I'm going to present to you is not just the who saved or who didn't save the Jews, but also the ethical implications of the witnesses who saw the Holocaust. The witnesses I'm going to talk about are five diarists, who were in Warsaw at the time of the war, or near Warsaw at the time of the war. They could see, they could smell the what was happening. Now, these people that you can see here, Iwaszkiewicz, Naukowska, Dąbrowska, Rembek, and Wileżyńska, that Ms. Majewska has already mentioned to you, these are more or less the same generation, well-known writers at that time, middle-aged writers. Today we would say they were very young, but at that time it was a different perception of age. And they were very well-known in the interwar period. They were also, all of them, and I'm now summarizing what connects them, the commonalities that connect them. They were extremely patriotic Polish Jews who rejoiced in the reestablishment of the Republic in 1818 after the war. We've just celebrated it here, the big event, and at the same time they were also deeply steeped in the intellectual, humanistic enlightenment, enlightenment climate of Europe, especially Western Europe. So they looked to Western Europe in the hope that Poles and the new Polish Republic, the Second Republic, will develop in the spirit of the second of the Western civilization, Western enlightenment, and so on and so forth. Now, you can imagine what happened when in 1939, not only the Germans were the ones who invaded, but also when the Republic fell in such a quick time. So you can imagine their disappointment and their shock. Now, not only that, but because they all, I chose these were people who were all, as I said, close to Warsaw. They also saw the extermination, the slow but inexorable extermination of the Jews. So they all saw the erection of the ghetto in 1940. They also saw the deportation to Treblinka in 42. And most traumatically, they watched the burning of the ghetto in the ghetto uprising in 43. Okay, so my subtitle, which was not here, was what my subtitle was, what did they see when they look at the ghetto? Now, of course, this is a paraphrase, as I mentioned, and you talked about Boinsky. As I mentioned, it's a paraphrase of Miłosz's famous poem. But before I talk about the poem a little bit, I just want to look at it literally. What did they really see when they looked at the ghetto? What could be seen when they looked at the ghetto? And I will suggest to you that what could be seen was the burning of the ghetto. What could be seen was the smoke. I have to be closer. If somebody was not like Stawisko, like Iwaszkiewicz was in Stawisko, he would still see the smoke above the ghetto. They could see the infamous, you know, carousela that we know, the merry-go-round that was so much written about, and they could see the walls of the ghetto, the burning walls of the ghetto. What they couldn't see was what was inside the walls, beyond the walls, what was going in there. And there, this was a matter of imagination. And I would like you to remember this notion of imagination, because imagination in this question that I am raising, how they saw the ghetto, what they saw, is extremely important. So now I am going to recall, the Miłosz's famous poem, and what he told us about, and I'm going to show you just an excerpt, since some people here speak Polish. So in honor of the poet, I'm going to read it in Polish, and you, those who can't, can see it in English. Wali się w ogniu dach. Ściana i żar ogarnia fundament. Jest już tylko piaszczysta, zdeptana, z jednym drzewem bez liści ziemia. In other words, what is above is completely destroyed. What is above ground is completely destroyed. The roofs, the lonely tree, and so on. Powoli, drążąc tunel, posuwa się strażnik Kret z małą czerwoną latarką przypiętą na czole. Dotyka ciał pogrzebanych, liczy, przedziera się dalej, rozróżnia ludzki popiół po tęczującym oparze. What I want you to pay attention here, this mole cannot see the names anymore, there are no names anymore. All he can do is distinguish by the ashes. He can distinguish, identify people. There's no names. The names have been erased. And I'm switching here to this part. Okay, and what he says is, boję się, tak się boję strażnika Kreta, jego obrzmiała powieka jak u patriarchy, który siadywał dużo w blasku świec, czytając wielką księgę gatunku. Now, let's look at this one. Cóż powiem mu ja, Żyd Nowego Testamentu, czekający od 2000 lat na powrót Jezusa? Moje rozbite ciało wyda mnie jego spojrzeniu i policzy mnie między pomocników śmierci nieobrzezanych. So what is happening here? What does he tell us? What he tells us is that no names anymore of the dead, but the patriarch can still distinguish between the circumcised and non-circumcised, those who were not circumcised. And because he is not circumcised, he feels that he's a helper of death. Not, he doesn't do it, but he is a collaborator with those that inflicted death. Not only that, he is the Jew of the New Testament, waiting for the second coming of Jesus. But since Jesus was circumcised, then we lost the opportunity of coming of the second coming, and with this the redemption. So this is the poet. The poet gives us a very striking image. But let us look now. Let us look now at the people who really were there and who watched it and who had to exercise their imagination to understand, to at least envisage or somehow see what was going on behind those scenes, how they reacted to it. I, two of my diarists, if you recall my five, the list of five diarists, two of my five diarists decided, or maybe didn't decide, but that's how they reacted, decided that they want to put a distance from it and they want basically to ignore it. One of them was Dombrowska. One of them was Dombrowska, and Dombrowska, if you can see it here, in April 1942, the ghetto uprising, a few days after the beginning of the ghetto uprising, she sees, "I saw billows of smoke above the ghetto where apparently the fighting still continues." What about imagination here? Apparently the fighting still continues. Her imagination, look, I just want to mention, because we don't have much time, but I want to how you can use imagination. You can use imagination apparently, maybe, perhaps, we don't know. This is what it looks like, okay? So what we have here is no attempt to penetrate imaginatively into the ghetto walls, but claim deliberate refusal to really confront, even in your imagination, what is happening. Then we have another person here who also doesn't want really to even imagine what can be there or what the Holocaust is all about. He was in Milanówek all the time, Rembek. So he says, presumably Warsaw Ghetto has been finished off, though opinions differ. At any rate, I meet all the time Jewish labor units going to or coming back from work. So since I am a literature person, I read text, so I'm introducing you to a very close reading of the text, and I am underlining the words that really struck me as trying to imaginatively avoid the imagination of the horror that is happening, that is really happening, and to deny, there is also a sense of denial of what really is happening. So there is no intention here of imagination of the liquidation of the Jews. But then we have other diaries. We have three other diaries. And they were altruistically and actively engaged in hiding Jews. Now, Ivaszkiewicz and his wife Anna were hiding Jews. Actually, I should say Anna and her husband Ivaszkiewicz, because she was behind the planning of finding places in Stawisko and outside of Stawisko. And Ivaszkiewicz was with her, helping her, but really she was the spirit behind all this. And so we have Ivaszkiewicz, we have, and I'm going to talk in a second. Oh, we have to, let me just take these people out and see what's happening. So Ivaszkiewicz, let's look at his exercise of his imagination. But by the way, let us remember that we're talking about writers. We are talking about people who use their imagination in terms of their profession as writing profession all the time. So what we have here is Ivaszkiewicz. We helplessly watch the dark smoke coming from the bodies, the houses, the bodies of my friends, and this is and their parents, and this is extremely difficult to comprehend and to live through. I don't even attempt to understand, but we must go on. Okay, so what we have here with Ivaszkiewicz is the admission, the confession that it is impossible to even imagine it, but yet he can see in his imagination the smoking, the burning of the bodies. Now I'm leaving you with this because I'm going to Wilczynska, who was really helping Jews constantly, on constant basis. She was helping Jews, trying to find places to hide and saving Jews as much as she could. And on April 23, 1943, when the ghetto was, you know, when it was a full revolt, she says, look at this, and let's try to think about her imagination, how this works. At my bedhead settle phantoms of people who are still alive, those who stayed outside the battlefield of the ghetto. In other words, I think that what she means is that those who were hiding on the Aryan side, but who belong there, because the final solution really placed all the Jews in the ghetto, not outside the ghetto. And they will torment me as the emissaries of those who were perishing. Now look at that. I mean, in her imagination, she feels, and here I'm throwing on purpose, I'm throwing a gun, she feels guilty. Okay, she feels guilty. They will be blaming me. Okay, they will be tormenting me for what is happening. Okay, now of course she was not guilty, but this is what I call the metaphysical guilt. It's not that you did something, but you have this idea that things should have been done and having been done, and you vicariously carry the responsibility for what is happening. And I want to tell you that the next one, who was Naukowska, well, this we can see. I wanted to show you some of the images, you know, that they could see from the outside. Yes, the people that were jumping. And then we have Naukowska, who also at the same time, April 1943, she wrote, I am next to the burning ghetto, and I live. How could I have been forced into this? To be alive means to acquiesce with it. In other words, to agree with this. Again, I just mentioned the metaphysical guilt. I think that we all can recognize what she says. And she goes on. This is infamy. Not only torment, horrendous shame. Now, shame that she has to witness it, and not to go insane is somehow sustain oneself in the midst of horror that evokes guilt. So what we have here, the three writers here, they use their imagination. And their imagination tells them, even though we cannot see everything, we can see something. And what we can see, this is the synagogue, okay, that she later on, Wilczynska, is describing when she later on went to Saw Ghetto. And this is the other picture of the synagogue. So what I'm trying at this, up till now, I was trying to show you that there were various responses to what they couldn't see, what they could only imagine. And the responses are what interests me. These are the responses of people who all their lives believed in progress, humanism, enlightenment, and hope that Poland will become like that, and what they see in the midst of their beloved city is this horror. Now, I want to shift a little bit my line of discussion, and I want to turn to the idea of diary. Because even those like Dąbrowska and Rembek, who did not try to imagine the horror, and those who did imagine the horror, all of them were recording. All of them were recording what was happening. Even though Dąbrowska, by the way, I'm just giving you, she wrote 5 sentences about the ghetto. That was all in her diary, but still she mentioned the smoke and so on. And they all wrote diaries. So I want to spend just a few moments on the idea of diary. How does the idea of diary help us to understand how these people responded, these writers responded to the tragedy that they were witnessing? They were bearing witness in their diaries. So let us talk about the diary for a few moments. The diary is really a genre that came to being in the 18th century when we have the focus on the individual, right? We have focus with the Enlightenment, the Encyclopedie, the Voltaire, the Rousseau, all the big philosophers. We have now the idea, and later on the French Revolution, of course, we have the idea that the individual is what comes. So diary comes from the acknowledgement of the importance of the individual. Yes, everybody is unique, and everybody can tell their story, and every story is important. So the journal, the journal intime that we have in the 18th century, became in the 19th century extremely popular. It was extremely popular not only because lots of people were writing diaries, but it became important also because they were published. There was enormous publishing industry of diaries. So now you can ask me, well, why should I be interested in your story and you should be interested in my story? I mean, after all, you know, what's the interest here? And I suggest to you that what we have in the 18th century is a concept that, of course, existed since humanity exists, but it was the concept that was conceptualized, and I'm still have some pictures here. It was the concept of empathy. The concept of empathy which made me interested in you and you interested in me, and the idea was based on the fact that we are equally important individuals. We are all important individuals. That's why I'm interested in reading about your life and connecting with it, because I can understand at some level, I can understand your pain and I can understand your happiness. And the same thing with you. You are interested in, that's why you're buying my diary, because you're interested in how I feel and what I feel and can connect with it at a certain level. I'm especially emphasizing the idea of connection. I mean, people are connected. They're connected because they can understand each other's feelings and ideas and thoughts. So they are minded as I am. You are minded as I am, okay? You are a minded person, I'm a minded person, and you is another I. In other words, I can never be you, but I can be another you. I respond to the world. There is something that connects us all. Okay, so coming back to our diaries, they were, as you can see, incredibly devoted to writing diaries. If I tell you that Dąbrowska had 50,000 pages, and Naukowska even more so, and they were all writing about their, and Rembek was writing had a few diaries, and Wileżyńska said, this is my child, this diary is my child, this is the most important thing that I've done, then you see how important it was. And indeed, they were all admirers of André Gide, Maria Bashkirtseff, Paul Valéry, among others, especially Gide. Gide was extremely important to them all. And so my question is, what happened? What happened to this idea of commonality that I have with other people and that I share with my diaries and you share in your diaries? What happened? Okay, so let us look at what Ivaškevič wrote. And I think that he refers to either Valéry, Paul Valéry, which was his idol before the war, or to Gide, which was another idol. They all admired Gide. And what he writes in 43, you see, 43, he writes this. Turning to this big guy who strolls along the boulevards of Paris, right, who did not suffer like Poland under the occupation, he says, can you smell the burning ghetto? Okay? Can you smell the burning ghetto? And as for me, when at noontime, you know, when I finish my writing, when I finish my work, tired of work, nourished by hope, because I created something, I feel full of flowers, laughing in June, the joy of a new dish mixed with ashes. I think that the idea, that the allusions to ghetto is clear. I mean, he says it, and then the ashes is a continuation. If you recall the previous quote that I gave you, all my friends are burning there, and I cannot do anything. So what we have is Ivaškevič that is now cannot trust this great French person, diarist, whether it's Gide or whether it's Valéry, he cannot trust him anymore because he would never imagine, again, back to the imagination, he will never imagine what I saw here and what happened here. Then let us look at Wileżyńska and let's see what she said about her idol. And I told you, Gide was their idol. She writes that Gide was in her diary, was her Bible. You know, the diary of Gide was her Bible. Okay, so what she says here is exactly her disappointment with Gide, right? There is what would he be thinking now when he saw what I saw? You know, where am I standing in my idolization of Gide in view of what is happening here? Okay, I hope that I don't want to belabor on that. I hope that we all see that. So all these pre-war models that really embodied the idea, the German idea of Bildung, yes, of becoming a better person, of sharing my life in order also to evaluate my life and become a better person. And by the way, I don't have the time to mention now, but Wileżyńska writes about it. She writes about it that when she's going to save Jews, it's her plan. And this is also to improve her own self, to improve her moral self, her ethical self. So what we see here is that they all disappointed in those great, great Western, and you recall, I repeated several times how they were into enlightenment and how they were into Western culture, and the diaries who shared with them their life, they cannot find the commonality anymore. There is no common experience that they can refer to when they, in other words, the empathy is limited here, the empathy falls. But I have one more question before the end. Okay, so where is their empathy? I mean, if empathy is the commonality of what we have together as human beings, can the witness who watches the Jews dehumanized and burned and degraded, can the humanist, the witness, maintain their empathy for the victim. This was, I think, the way I read the diaries, this was the question that preoccupied them immensely. And this was the question that they found themselves lacking in the in finding the answer they would have liked to find. So, is the legacy of the Enlightenment strong enough to overcome the dehumanization of the Jew by the final solution, by the idea of the final solution, and continue to treat them, to treat the Jews as if against this this terrible subhumanizing of the Jews? Well, this is a big question, and let us first look at the two diaries who didn't want to identify or imagine them to begin with, and let's look at Dombrowska. And Dombrowska, June 44. Now, June 44 is after the ghetto uprising, right? And it is before, just before the Polish uprising, right? Polish uprising was 1st of August. Okay, so what she writes here, and I am inviting you to read it, is that, you know, thanks to the disappearance of the Jews, we are flourishing now in Warsaw. I tell you what, it's not even that it's not sensitive. It's simply not true, because in Poland, in Warsaw, in 44, people were not flourishing. People were living under terrible occupation. The Russians were coming, so the Germans were even more oppressive than they were before. And it's true that some people always make it, but most of the people were really deprived, sick all the time. Even the diaries, like Naukowska, anybody knows about Naukowska? She had a tobacco store that she had to maintain her mother, who died in the meantime, her family. She moved, had to move from one place to another. Dombrowska herself was destitute. You know, they were asking Iwaszkiewicz to help them. Rembek was sick. He was in Milanówek. They were cold and sick and had no food all the time. I mean, and Wileżyńska was going to her estate of her family to bring some food because there was no food in Warsaw. So even in terms of the truth of what was happening, Dombrowska has not even imagination for her own fellow Poles, because she's so preoccupied with the apparently positive disappearance of the Jews. Now Rembek, we have Rembek here too. The town seems empty without Jews, but this is something good for our economy. So here we have people who really didn't want, they were not sympathizing with Jews, never mind empathy. But what about Iwaszkiewicz? Okay, what about Iwaszkiewicz? Iwaszkiewicz in 41, he goes through the ghetto, and look what he sees. He sees total dehumanization. He sees enormous degradation of human beings, of even of human bodies. Okay, he says beggars with terrible white faces, covered with corpses, covered with newspaper. He sees something that Karski saw when he went, when he infiltrated into the ghetto and saw what was happening there. And he says, look, and then he says, occasionally I get news from them, but they seem written from another world. To me, and you know, we can discuss it later, from another world. The commonality, there is sympathy, there is pity, there is compassion. But empathy, I mean, can I identify these people as if they belong to the same world as mine? And I'm just throwing this idea at you, because this is something that, you know, I certainly don't have definitive answer. I think that he found it very, very difficult. If you look at Wileżyńska, okay, what Wileżyńska has here, she talks about somebody, Robert. It's not his real name, of course, Robert, whom she was hiding. And what she says, what would I have done had I been in this situation, okay? And what she says is, I think, in terms of normal existential reactions, to be or not to be, either kill yourself or save yourself. And there is a third alternative, lack of will, indecisiveness, okay? So the Germans create the weakness of the will in the victims. And then let's look at Naukowska. Naukowska, who was trying to save Bruno Schulz, they failed the last moment. She couldn't, but she was trying to save. She says, why don't they go under empty sky to open fields and in the forests? Why are they suffering? This degradation, this dehumanization, destitution, this terrible extermination, this something that makes them really haunted creatures who are trying to avoid death. So what I claim to you, and we can discuss it later, of course, that it was extremely difficult to maintain empathy at the time when they were looking at what was happening with the Jews. And I think that we have to keep it in mind when we talk about witnessing. When we talk about witnessing, and we have so much tragedies and horrors that are happening in the world today, and we can see it all, because now we can see it all on television and all that. And the question is our attitude to people who are going such horrible degradation and horrible suffering, and our desire, or maybe self-defense, that emerges in this kind of accusation. Why didn't they? I would have done something else, and so on and so forth. I just am throwing this at you because these people were really noble people. I mean, the three diaries were so really noble, exceptional, and the very fact that they were asking themselves this question was testifies to their sense of self-criticism, where they are. So let me summarize. The genesis of the diary and its reception represented the legacy of the Enlightenment. It was the legacy of human fellowship, grounded in empathic understanding of human beings as same subjects. In the time of the genocide, the diary's function shifted. It documented the breakdown of the empathic horizon in times of genocidal terror. The license to mass murder a human group for irrevocable biological reasons transformed the essence of social interaction. In this sense, the diaries confirmed the fear of the poor Christian in Miłosz's poem about being a helper of death. The unbridgeable abyss between the Jewish planet of death and the Christian planet of life obliterated the empathic recognition of you as another I. In this sense, the witness's attitude corroborated the intention of the perpetrator. Thus, the experience of the witness commands us to be constantly conscious of the vulnerability of humanism, which has shown how easily the empathic sameness of human being can be abolished. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dziękuję bardzo. To był bardzo ciekawy wykład. I teraz zapraszam Państwa do zadawania pytań, komentowania, dzielenia się swoimi spostrzeżeniami. Skoro nie ma na razie pytań z widowni, to ja chciałabym zacząć. Może masz ochotę, Rachel, usiąść z nami? Tak? Dobrze, to ja poczekam ze swoim. Tak, proszę bardzo.
Już? Maj Włodzimierz, jestem nauczycielem historii. I ja tu mam takie pytanie. Mianowicie było mowa o tym, że jeden z tych dzienników było wspomniane, że bez Żydów byłoby się lepiej. Otóż ucząc,
że Żydom było lepiej?
Że bez Żydów byłoby się lepiej, w tym jednym, ja ich dobrze zrozumiałem, że bez Żydów byłoby się lepiej. Otóż tu, ucząc historii, warto się odwoływać do naszej historii Polski. Mianowicie, kiedy w Polsce było dużo mniejszości narodowych, akurat żyło się dobrze. Wystarczy powiedzieć XVI wiek, dopóki nas te wojny nie zniszczyły. A więc twierdzenie, że jak nie ma mniejszości, w tym Żydów, będzie lepiej, jest nieprawdą. I tu do tego trzeba się odwoływać, że istnienie mniejszości nie pogarsza sytuacji większości, a ich polepsza. Dlaczego? Bo daje impuls wielokulturowy i mniejszości zawsze wnoszą coś nowego w rozwój gospodarczy czy kulturalny większości, a więc to jest dla wspólnego dobra. Poza tym wydaje mi się, że mówiąc o Holokauście czy innych przeżyciach tragicznych, dobrze jest, żeby spotkania też kiedyś takie zaplanować o tym, co dobrego dało nam wspólne sąsiedztwo. Nie można patrzeć przecież przez pryzmat naszej historii Polski, wspólnego przebywania Polaków i Żydów w kontekście zagłady. Bo tak wygląda, jakby nas łączyło tylko Holokaust i Treblinka i kto komu świństwo zrobił. Dziękuję.
Ja mogę powiedzieć tylko, że ja się z Panem zgadzam. Nie ma tu żadnych... ja nie mam... Żydzi żyli przez wiele wieków w Polsce. Pan jest historyk, to pan lepiej wie ode mnie, bo ja nie jestem historykiem, że w XX wieku w całej Europie doszło do faszyzmu i się zmieniły stosunki w stosunku do mniejszości i tak dalej, i tak dalej. Ale ja się z panem zupełnie, absolutnie zgadzam. Ja mam nadzieję, że tak będzie dalej, co znaczy, że będzie dalej, że ludzie uznają, że właśnie mniejszości są te, które dodają właśnie i ulepszają i otwierają horyzonty i tak dalej, i tak dalej. Więc my jesteśmy, mamy tą samą, same poglądy.
Odnoszę wrażenie, że pani, may I speak Polish, or you prefer to...
Ja pójdę trochę bliżej, bo ja tak nie słyszę.
Proszę. May I speak Polish, or do you prefer...
Whichever.
Whichever, okej. Mam takie wrażenie, że pani chyba zbyt wąsko potraktowała ten bardzo głęboki i ważny temat. Mianowicie same dzienniki jeszcze nie oddają oczywiście stosunku polskich intelektualistów do Holokaustu, do problemu żydowskiego i tak dalej. Przede wszystkim dziwi mnie, że pani nie zainteresowała się w tym kontekście Zofią Kossak-Szczucką i jej wypowiedziami na temat Jedwabnego. Także była taka para pisarzy, Helena Boguszewska i Jerzy Kornacki, którzy również z określonych powodów, wiadomych zresztą, mieli do tego problemu no, zupełnie inny stosunek niż Maria Dąbrowska czy Stanisław Rembek. Czy to założenie pani było tak, no bo to w gruncie rzeczy ogranicza naszą interpretację tego problemu. Czy pani nie ma takiego wrażenia, że pani zbyt zacieśniła obraz?
Proszę pani, ja mam wrażenie, ja widzę, co pani, ja doskonale rozumiem, co pani mówi i w pewnym sensie tak, ja się skoncentrowałam na tekstach, które były pisane podczas, Szucka napisała potem, to był memoir, to nie był diary, to był memoir, który ona napisała po Auschwitz, jak ona była po Oświęcimiu, ale to nie jest, każdy robi, ja nie mogę zrobić wszystkiego. Ale mi się wydaje, że zamiast mówić, tak jak na przykład mówi, ten artykuł, który napisał, Błoński, tak, ten artykuł na przykład to napisał Błoński. Proszę pani, to jest generalizowanie. Co ja chciałam zrobić, to przynajmniej pokazać, że to nie jest takie proste i że to się różnią się, ludzie się różnią. I ja wybrałam, ja się z panią zgadzam, ale ja musiałam w pewnym sensie tak, ja się z panią zupełnie zgadzam, musiałam ograniczyć. Ja wzięłam tylko właśnie tych intelektualistów, którzy podczas tego pisali w Warszawie. Także ja się z panią zgadzam na ten temat, ale mnie się wydaje, że nie dużo, o ile ja robiłam, jak ja robiłam moją pracę naukową nad tym, to mi się wydaje, że nie dużo ludzi pisało o tym. O tych diaristach, this diarist i tych pamiętnikach, i którzy, jak oni się odnosili, co oni pisali i tego. A właśnie wszyscy mówią o tym, co on mówi, tak, to mnie się wydaje, że trzeba wejść w tą historię, która była wtedy. Ja może to robię niedobrze, czy ja to robię, ale to była moja intencja, żeby ich się popatrzeć na nich jak ludzie, którzy żyli tam, którzy widzieli to, którzy mieli wielu żydowskich przyjaciół, bo przecież my wiemy, że oni wszyscy byli w takim milieu artystycznym, tak, to byli wszyscy ludzie, którzy się znali jeden drugiego i mnie się wydaje, że zrobić to bardziej skomplikowane, to co ja się starałam zrobić, ale ja się z panią zgadzam, że ja na pewno nie napisałam o wielu innych rzeczach, które trzeba było napisać, ja tylko chciałam otworzyć właśnie tą dyskusję, że to nie było takie jednolite. To była moja intencja.
Ja mam takie pytanie, bo kilka razy w twoim wykładzie pojawiło się hasło tej winy metafizycznej. I przed kim oni czują się winni? Przed kim im wstyd? Przed sobą samym? Przed rodziną? Czy przed Żydami?
To jest bardzo trudny koncept. Metaphysical guilt. To jest bardzo trudny koncept. Ja się postaram znowu, ja upraszczam, ale się rozumiem, że jest, my mamy psychologicznie, my mamy swoje ideal ego, idealne wyobrażenie siebie, obraz siebie, idealny obraz, który my chcemy przez całe życie się staramy, żeby do tego obrazu jakoś dojść, Nigdy nie można oczywiście, ale to jest w naszej psychice, tak? My mamy ten... Tak. Mnie się wydaje, że w tym sensie można zrozumieć, przynajmniej trochę, nie zupełnie, ale przynajmniej trochę można zrozumieć metaphysical guilt. To nie jest to, że ja zrobiłam coś, ale to jest to, że ja nie mogę w tym momencie zupełnie, odchodzę od tego mojego idealnego obrazu. Teraz proszę też pamiętać o tym, ja mówiłam o tym, proszę też pamiętać o tym, że oni wszyscy byli patriotami, to nie było, że to była jedyna rzecz. Ja mówię o tej rzeczy, która dla nich była wielką tragedią, to byli Żydzi, którzy ginęli tam i, tak, i to było w środku ich miasta. Ale były różne inne sprawy też. Ja starałam się to nawiązać do tego, jak ja miałam na przykład 39 rok, upadek Polski. Oni piszą o tym w swoich dziennikach, jaki to był dla nich szok, dla wszystkich. To wszyscy byli tego. Jaki to był straszny szok dla nich, upadek 39 roku. Więc też coś nie grało, coś ten obraz idealny tego Polaka, który odzyskał swoją niepodległość, tak, w taki zupełnie cud jakby się stał, też ten upadek. I oni piszą o tym, jak oni byli oszukani. Oni piszą, Naukowska pisze zupełnie wyraźnie, Dąbrowska pisze o tym, Rembek ma, ja nie mogę wejść w to wszystko, ale on ma też opowiadania, które pisze i on poszedł obronić Warszawę i on się nie mógł tam nigdzie dostać, on nawet nie mógł się dostać, a on był oficerem armii w pierwszej wojnie, w wojnie bolszewicko-polskiej w 18-21 i więc oni mieli różne inne też straszne rozczarowania do tego właściwie obrazu, do którego i nacjonalnie, i indywidualnie oni chcieli dojść. To mnie się wydaje, że to może być wytłumaczenie tego metaphysical guilt, tej winy metafizycznej, którą oni odczuwali.
Mam jeszcze jedno pytanie. A, jeszcze tu się proszę.
Chciałam zapytać, co według Pani uniemożliwiało czy utrudniało współodczuwanie czy te empatie polskich obserwatorów wobec żydowskich przyjaciół uwięzionych w getcie? Czy to było fizyczne odcięcie, niemożność przebywania w getcie? Czy ten cały proces...
O czym Pani mówi? O Kielcach?
Mam wrażenie, że to jest troszkę inne zniuansowanie też samego słowa po polsku i po angielsku, ale jestem ciekawa, jak pani to tłumaczy, ten brak empatii.
Dobrze, ja mogę to wytłumaczyć, ale może nie wszystkim to będzie bardzo niepodobne. Proszę pani. Wybaczcie mi, że ja powiem może coś takiego, że ludzie nie chcą słuchać. Ale proszę pani, oni naprawdę zmienili Żydów. Kompletnie. Oni się naprawdę zrobili jak zwierzęta, które uciekają przed tego. Więc jak ja mogę, ja, która tam rozmawiałam intelektualnie, miałam intelektualne rozmowy z tymi osobami, muzyka, jak oni byli nadzwyczajnie wszyscy wykształceni i tak, to my wszyscy wiemy. I nagle ci ludzie stają się, oni piszą o tych w dziennikach, oni piszą o tym, że nagle ci ludzie stają się, oni tylko są zaabsorbowani tym, żeby uciec, żeby się uratować, żeby się ukryć. A teraz oni ukrywali i Waszkiewicz, i Wyleżyńska, oni ukrywali ludzi, których oni znali. Znaczy to nie byli obcy ludzie, to było większość. Może byli tam obcy ludzie, oni nie mogą też o tym pisać, bo nie można było pisać, ale większość było ludzi, których oni znali ze swoich. I nagle ci ludzie się zupełnie zmieniają. I ten szok, dobrze, ten szok dla Żydów, że nagle oni mają być zamordowani, masowe morderstwo, to jest jedna rzecz, ale druga rzecz jest ten szok dla tych ludzi, którzy znali ich wszystkich i nagle co ten Final Solution zrobił, co ten to po prostu rozdzielił. On naprawdę rozdzielił człowieczeństwo, więc jak ja mówię ten empathy, jak ja mówię o tej empatii, to i Żydzi przestali odczuwać empatię. Oni wszyscy mówili, a wy jesteście tacy szczęśliwi, wy nie macie tego. Ale oni też nie byli tacy szczęśliwi, bo wszyscy wiemy, jak ktoś ukrywał Żydów, to nie było takie łatwe i to wcale nie było bezpieczne. Oczywiście wszyscy wiemy, ja tylko mówię w ten sposób. Ale tak oni rozdzielili człowieczeństwo. No, ja piszę o tym w innym kontekście, ale to jest mniej więcej, to jest moja odpowiedź na to. To nagle coś się zrobiło zupełnie inna, zupełnie inne zachowanie, zupełnie inne odczucie, zupełnie wszystkie koncepcje się zmieniły. My dzisiaj nie możemy sobie wyobrazić, ale ja zawsze to mówię, proszę się nie obrazić na mnie, ale nagle gdyby ktoś tutaj wszedł i powiedział, dlatego że wy tutaj słyszycie Brenner, to wiecie, no tak, wszyscy mają tutaj, to jest mniej więcej tak samo, co byśmy zrobili. Myśmy się przede wszystkim kompletnie zmienili, czy ten świat od zewnątrz by nas zrozumiał, o co tutaj chodzi. Ja pani tylko daję parę tego, co ja myślę w tej chwili, parę myśli, ale to jest trudno zrozumieć, ale tak to było.
Więc jeżeli już nie ma więcej pytań, to bardzo dziękuję. To był niezwykle ciekawy dla nas wykład. Dziękuję również Państwu za uwagę i za to, że chcecie z nami spędzić piątkowy wieczór. Do widzenia.
Dziękuję bardzo. Dziękuję.